You're listening to the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda, also in Washington, D.C. Good to be back with you,
Katie.
How
you doing, Ankit?
Doing well.
Yeah. Well, it's been a wild July, I think, in the United States. Between heat waves, we have had one attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump during a rally in Pennsylvania, July 13th. And then a couple days later, his presumptive opponent, President Joe Biden, dropped out of the race, following a poor debate performance and mounting pressure within the Democratic Party. Biden quickly endorsed his Vice President Kamala Harris for the Democratic Party's nomination. Prominent party leaders followed suit. She's expected to become the formal nominee next month in August after the Democratic Party convention in Chicago. So after that, it's really off to the races. So we thought that Ankit and I thought that it was a good time for us to discuss the US presidential election. You know, certainly being watched around the world before July, but it's arguably a new game now. We have a new face heading the Democratic ticket, and the Republican ticket is fully set with the naming of Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as Trump's running mate during the Republican Party convention in July. So for our purposes here at Asia Geopolitics, of course, Ankit and I wanted to dive into how Asia feels about this election and a little about what we expect from the candidates on the foreign policy front as the election really starts to get going. So Ankit, with that prelude, you know, an often repeated mantra is that Asian leaders are anxious in regard to U.S. commitment to the Indo-Pacific, U.S. allies in particular. How are these countries viewing the state of the U.S. election at this point?
Yeah, so, you know, big question. Asia's a big place, but I think in general terms, I think anxiety is a good way to frame it, but it also kind of smooths over, I think, the complexity that I think lingers for certain countries, probably less the allies and more the adversaries and certain partner countries. You know, India, I think, is a pretty interesting case here that we can maybe talk about a little more. But, you know, from the perspective of allies, adversaries, and partners alike, I think the way to frame the stakes in this election is, you know, a consistent, predictable United States is something of a load-bearing structure for regional order in the Indo-Pacific. Having a United States that, you know, pledges fealty to certain norms, be that, you know, freedom of navigation or non-proliferation or maintaining a forward-deployed capability to deter conflicts, to respond to crises and contingencies. That's something that Asian countries have been used to, certainly in the post-Cold War context. And so the stakes in this election, I think, are rather apparent from that perspective, because obviously the two tickets have a fairly divergent view of the U.S. role in the world. Now, I will say, you know, if this was a European geopolitics podcast, I think we would potentially have to make a, you know, put a finer point on this, because I think, especially on the Republican side of the aisle, the Trump-Vance ticket, I think, has substantially greater misgivings about Europe, per se, than it does about Asia. But again, that's complex, too. I mean, just in the broader sense of allies here, I think the sense that I've gotten on my recent trips to the region and engagements with Asian officials, there is a sense that the United States, even if the Trump-Vance ticket wins, will need Asia quite a bit more, because Trump and Vance continue to, of course, stake out a fairly hawkish position towards China, which remains really an area of bipartisan agreement between the two parties, but with differences in how that policy might be implemented. But there isn't really the kind of talk that you really see about Europe, where, you know, Vance notably has been probably the member of the Senate that is certainly in favor of the United States walking away from Ukraine, forcing Zelensky to sue for peace. Now, of course, that's not viewed favorably in Asia, particularly among countries like, you know, Japan, Australia, partner states that have been rather forcefully in support of the U.S. policy towards Ukraine. But it does it doesn't necessarily accompany broader baggage about what the United States might do vis-a-vis its allies. Now, there's exceptions to this, right? We talked about South Korea recently, where, you know, increasingly in South Korea, it's not uncommon to hear the view that if Trump and Vance are elected, South Korea is going to have to build nuclear weapons, or that the alliance will not survive. Again, you know, a lot of practical questions there, but the anxieties I do think are real. Now, Kamala Harris, interesting from the perspective of Asia in many ways. You know, as vice president, she has traveled to Asia four times. She's actually met Xi Jinping, which is pretty interesting, given that, you know, it's not the protocol arrangement you'd expect. You know, Biden had met Xi when he was vice president, so it's somewhat unusual that Kamala would have met Xi Jinping, given that she's the incumbent vice president. But also, she's met the incumbent Taiwanese president, Lai Ching-te. She's met Kishida in Japan, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. So having these personal relationships, I do think, gives a certain sense of familiarity to foreign leaders and governments. But, you know, the broader picture here, I think, is that Harris represents continuity in broad strokes. But the continuity also raises certain anxieties, right? Because I think many allies in the region would love to see a United States or a U.S. president that was able to make the case, as Obama did, for instance, for trade liberalization in the region. Harris won't do that, right? She's not going to flip the script on the Indo-Pacific economic framework, bring the United States back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership or anything like that. But, you know, Harris, in a way, would represent stability. So if I had to guess, I mean, from the perspective of the allies, right, a Harris administration would be preferable from the sense of maintaining continuity, allowing a lot of the initiatives that have now been in, that have now started under the Biden administration to continue and evolve, you know, things like trilateral cooperation between Japan and South Korea, AUKUS, all of that, I think, kind of remains on the rails if Harris were to prevail in the election.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And it is worth sort of diving a little bit into Harris's, the differences in experience, really, between Harris and Trump when it comes to Asia. Obviously, Donald Trump was president and had plenty of engagements in Asia, not all of them extremely positive. And on the other hand, Harris has represented the United States at the ASEAN summit and the East Asia summit in 2023. Joe Biden didn't go, Kamala Harris did. She's met with the heads of all of the U.S. treaty allies in Asia. So Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, and Thailand. And so I think, you know, your point on continuity is well taken. And a question that I have is, you know, you mentioned sort of that we can't really expect Kamala Harris to kind of make a U-turn on some of the trade liberalization issues and sort of the free trade agreement front. But we can't really see that happening in the Donald Trump administration either, or second Donald Trump administration. So maybe we should kind of dive into Donald Trump and his engagements in Asia and what we can expect. And I think one of the things that we can expect is that it's hard to predict what could happen. I mean, I think his engagements with North Korea are a perfect story in that regard.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that's exactly the right place to start, which is that, you know, Trump is capricious, he is unpredictable, and I think the insight about a second Trump administration, broadly speaking, is that, you know, this time it won't be staffed with some of the more traditional Republican national security figures that were in the first Trump administration that sort of kept Trump, if not on the rails, then at least within the guardrails of a general foreign policy approach that didn't result in the termination of treaty alliances or the United States doing something completely brash. But, you know, we did see things like the Trump-Kim summits, which were very much kind of not focused on non-proliferation ends, but more on kind of the spectacle of it all, you know, demanding $5 billion from South Korea and cost-sharing talks, so on and so forth. So I think the anxiety is that, you know, if Trump is reelected, what's to stop him from changing the terms with the Aussies on the AUKUS deal, right? Right now, it is a cooperative defense industrial partnership. The United States is going to be selling Virginia-class submarines to Australia. Trump could take a page out of the South Korean cost-sharing talks and simply slap on a multiple billion-dollar figure on top of the cost of the Virginia-class submarines for the Aussies, right? That's just one example. So I think that anxiety does exist. It's something that allies can't control, right? The thing that I've kind of been telling, you know, folks in allied governments largely is, like, you know, focus on the things you can control, because you cannot control how a second Trump term is likely to affect your country. You can't hedge against it. And so also, I think the confidence that's sort of built up after having dealt with the first Trump administration, I think maybe helps in that regard, because I think the allies understand that Trump responds well to personal flattery, you know, letting him win at golf, probably a good thing for some Asian national leaders to start improving their golf game, but not too much, because you can't beat Trump at golf. But certainly, you know, having that personal relationship with the president did seem to matter quite a bit, right? I think the late Shinzo Abe in Japan, I think, was a really good example of that. Abe, of course, rushes to New York with a gold golf club in November 2016 after Trump wins, makes sure that he's one of the first leaders to show up at the White House and then at Mar-a-Lago in early 2017. So I expect we'll see a similar dynamic. But I think there will be fundamentally still be anxiety, just given the fact that this time a Trump administration is substantially less likely to be bounded. And, you know, we can talk a bit about the Vance, the J.D. Vance vice presidential pick. You know, vice presidents, of course, matter at the margins in terms of internal administration debates and deliberations on foreign policy questions. So probably not best to overread Vance's role within a second Trump administration. But given what he represents in terms of a clear shift away from the more Reaganite internationalist foreign mm-hmm. policy thought of the Republican Party, right, in a way that, you know, Mike Pence was not in the first Trump administration, I think that too sends a message to allies that a second Trump administration might substantially manifest in a sharper turn in U.S. foreign policy. But, you know, Katie, what's your, you know, just kind of looking at the other parts of Asia that we haven't really talked about too much, you know, Southeast Asia, Oceania, Central Asia, even South Asia. What are kind of your expectations for how the stakes in this election, particularly on the Trump-Vance side of things, look?
Yeah, I mean, so to go to my favorite place in the world, Central Asia, I was in Kyrgyzstan in June, so sort of before all of the craziness, when this really sort of looked like a rematch between Biden and Trump, and that's what we all expected. Obviously, people asked me about the election and what I felt about it and what I was watching. I got the sense. It's sort of a spectacle, certainly from the Central Asian perspective. Central Asian elections are not nearly as exciting as this. And so I think there is a degree of spectacle in that. There's always been a degree of sort of appreciation for Donald Trump's flair. I think some of that rests in the, frankly, decent relationships he has with autocratic leaders and the assumption that he's not going to criticize them in the way and in the tone that Democratic administrations in their view do criticize these governments. But that said, I don't know that a second Trump administration would pay any more attention to Central Asia than the first Trump administration did. I think there's maybe more in-depth conversation we can have about Oceania when it comes to China in the Pacific and sort of U.S. efforts to represent itself in the Pacific as a reliable partner. It will get interesting because, you know, the Marshall Islands are not a country that Donald Trump can demand $5 billion from the way he can demand it from South Korea. And they have other options readily available in China. And so I think it will be interesting to see if there's continuity in the Trump perspective on China. And the reason that I have some question about that is because Donald Trump does tend to flip his opinion very quickly sometimes. I think it might be sort of it's not the perfect example, but the TikTok ban in the United States is an interesting case study in Donald Trump being really for it and then now being really against it. And that it's the opinion that he is putting forward is not necessarily rooted in real, like, ideological clay. It's not very deeply rooted. It's opportunistic. And so I think that creates opportunities for some countries if they can kind of present themselves as a good opportunity to get Donald Trump and his administration something that they want. But it is transactional. And I think that that's a degree of some of these countries are seeking stability in these relationships. And so that transactional style is not necessarily going to get him very far. I am curious what you sort of think on the China question. You know, do you expect Donald Trump to remain a China hawk, or could you is it reasonable to foresee the kind of better relationship that he has with, like, Vladimir Putin emerging there too?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's a really good question. I would say the sense I have from traveling to China recently and talking to many Chinese observers of the United States is that, you know, no matter what happens in this election, U.S.-China strategic competition will persist. It's really going to be the flavor of that competition. You know, in the scenario where, you know, a Trump-Vance White House is able to force Ukraine and Russia to reach some kind of war-terminating agreement, even if it's a frozen conflict, I think the concern then is that the United States will be able to actually pivot its attention towards Asia in a way that is likely not to be to China's benefit. I think we also saw towards the end of the first Trump administration that Chinese leadership, I think, had real concerns that the United States might be setting I mean, I don't think this was based in any reality, but there was a concern that the U.S. might actually do something that could precipitate a conflict or a war with China. So, you know, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, had to call his Chinese counterpart to sort of offer reassurances that this just wasn't what the United States was doing. So, you know, I think those anxieties would persist. I think Taiwan anxieties with both kind of a Harris presidency and a Trump presidency there. But I would say, you know, with Trump specifically, given his willingness to kind of cast aside longstanding shibboleths in foreign policy or precedents, I think China might be a little bit more concerned that Trump could do something dramatic, like authorize American weapon deployments to Taiwan or something that could really spark a crisis or a conflict between the two countries. No direct talk of that, you know, in the platform. Really, the framing of competition with China, I think, will persist. But I think that's kind of the top line concern. What's also interesting with Trump is that, you know, the character of U.S.-China economic competition would change, right? Democrats have been focused a lot on de-risking and supply chain resilience and diversification, but less so on or less obsessed with tariffs. I think Trump continues to indicate that if he is reelected, tariffs are going to be a preferred tool once again for managing geoeconomic disagreements with allies and adversaries alike, right? It's not just going to be China, but it will especially affect China in that sense, I think. Maybe we can close out a bit by talking about India, because I think it's actually a really interesting case here, right? I think, you know, the thought that I had about India, and I think this is really based on some of the writing that's been coming out from Indian commentators about the stakes in this U.S. election, is that, I mean, on some level, I think the Indians are looking to make lemonade no matter who's elected in the United States, right? So there are, I think, things that India might not enjoy under a Harris administration and under a Trump administration. But the broader U.S.-India strategic partnership, I think, is likely to persist in some version. What's really interesting, I think, is the sense in some parts of India that a Trump fans ticket is significantly likely to take pressure off of Russia, which is likely to then benefit India, right? I think some people have also cited things like, you know, J.D. Vance being critical of the U.S. Potentially threatening sanctions on India for India purchasing the S-400 surface-to-air missile system from Russia. This was a few years ago. You know, Vance has talked about India being one of the most important U.S. allies in the region, not literally true in the treaty ally sense, but certainly, I think, expresses a sense of closeness there. And then on the flip side, I think the concern that I think has sort of festered during the Biden administration is the growing concerns among Democrats in particular about the changing character of India politically, right? So more concerns about human rights, about democratic regression in India. So those concerns would likely continue to persist under a Harris administration, potentially serving as an irritant for the U.S.-India relationship. But, you know, beyond that, you know, I think at the working level, a lot of the stuff that has sort of proceeded over the last few years that has survived from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, I think a lot of that is likely to remain on track, regardless of the election outcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an entirely reasonable view on how India looks at this election, because you're right, there are these sort of through lines that, regardless of which candidate becomes president next, there are drivers for the India-U.S. relationship that sort of exist beyond the domestic politics of the United States. But I do think the Russia piece is really interesting, and something worth watching is as this campaign gets underway, and as there, I don't know if there's going to be another debate. We'll see. The last I had read, Donald Trump didn't want to debate Kamala Harris, so we'll see if there's another opportunity for the two candidates to face off and perhaps answer questions about what their foreign policy ideas will be, because I think we don't really have a great sense quite yet. I think we have the Republican Party's platform, and we'll have the Democratic Party's after their convention in a couple of weeks. But until then, we're kind of going off of I hate to say it, but vibes. We're going off our assumptions.
Everything
about
is vibes these days.
Everything's vibes these days. It's an election. I think that's the other sort of interesting thing. One more note about Central Asia is that it's sort of I would be confronted with people who assume that Donald Trump is going to win. They're 100% certain about it. And I say, well, if you look at the polls, it's kind of 50-50. And so my answer is it's 50-50. We don't know until Election Day. And that remains true in the United States. We don't know till Election Day. So it'll be worth watching for certain.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, this is certainly not going to be the last podcast we do this year on the 2024 U.S. election. Certainly a lot of relevance across the region. You know, maybe we can come back and do dedicated episodes on specific Asian subregions and the stakes in the U.S. election. I think that'd be an interesting way to kind of delve into the two parties and their differences on foreign policy. But I guess, you know, I mean, the other thing to say is that, you know, this is largely speaking not going to be an election about American foreign policy, with perhaps the exception being certain turnout dynamics relating to the Israel-Gaza war. But, mm-hmm. you know, Asian geopolitics, I don't think, are really going to be at the top of the minds of American voters. But they'll certainly be on the top of the mind for us. So we will be back to talk about it.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. If you have an opportunity, please like us, leave a review, recommend us to a friend. And as always, you are welcome to get in touch with Ankit or I with ideas for future episodes. We'll be back soon.